4:30. The order, known to prisoners as the prayer, would be given. Your attention, prisoners. You will keep strict column order on the line of march. You will not straggle or bunch up. You will not change places from one rank of five to another. You will not talk or look around to either side, and you will keep your arms behind you. A step to right or left will be considered an attempt to escape, and the escort will open fire without warning. First rank. Forward march. 4. Apart from sleeping, the prisoners' time was their own only for 10 minutes at breakfast, 5 minutes at the noon break, and another 5 minutes at supper. They lost so much sleep that they fell asleep instantly if they found a warm spot, and on the Sundays they got off, which was not every Sunday, they slept as much as they could. The shoe situation varied. There'd been times when they'd gone around all winter without any felt boots at all, times when they hadn't even seen ordinary boots, but only shoes made of birch bark or shoes of the Chelyabinsk tractor factory model, that is, made of strips of tires that left marks of the treads behind them. 7. Clothes were usually carefully patched and repaired, rags tied around them with all their bits of string and their faces wrapped in rags from chin to eyes to protect them from the cold. Ulcers are reported as common, through filthy clothes. Clothing was cleaned and disinfected occasionally, and baths were also provided. Solzhenitsyn implies that in the penal camp he describes, a bath was available about every 2 weeks. But often there was no soap for either bathing or laundry. To go sick for the odd day was possible with a minor complaint. But to be recognized as sick and put on a sick diet was usually fatal. In any case, even a man feeling ill might not be allowed to go sick, as there was a quota, he was allowed to excuse only 2 men in the morning, and he'd already excuse them. As a rule, the infirmary took in only those who were plainly dying, and not all of them, a Soviet woman writer recalls. In one camp, still under construction, a sick inspection is described. The Naryadchik and the Lekpom, medical assistant, armed with clubs, enter the pit. The chief asks the first man he sees why he does not come out. "I am sick," is the answer. The Lekpom feels his pulse and pronounces him all right. Then blows shower upon the man and he is kicked out into the open. "Why don't you go to work?" the chief asks the next man. "I am sick," is the stubborn answer. The day before, this prisoner went to the Lekpom and gave him his last dirty louse-infected shirt. The Lekpom feels his pulse and finds high fever. He is released from work. A third man replies that he has neither clothes nor shoes. "Take the clothes and shoes from the sick one," the chief rules. Sententiously. The sick one refuses, whereupon his things are taken off him by force. The veteran convicts in one day and the life of Ivan Denisovich have learned that it is necessary to march as slowly as possible to the morning job, otherwise they get hot too early, and won't last long. And in fact, those who survived the first months became fantastically skilled in the arts of survival. At the same time, customs useful to them became thoroughly established and traditional. For example, Solzhenitsyn describes the prisoners' habit of picking up odd scraps of wood on the building site and marching back with them. This was illegal, but the guards did nothing about it until they reached camp again. They then ordered them to throw down the wood, as they, too, needed extra fuel and were unable to carry any in addition to their submachine guns. But only a certain amount of the wood was dropped. At the next checkpoint, the warders repeated the order. Again, only a certain amount of wood was dropped, and the prisoners reached the quarters with a portion of their original gleanings. It was necessary, and in the interests of both guards and warders, that the prisoners be able to get away with some wood, otherwise they would have no incentive to bother to carry it in, and guards and warders would not have got their share. But no overt arrangement had ever been made. The agreement was wholly unspoken. We see, in such things, the development of the rules and traditions of a whole new social order, in microcosm. A genuine caste feeling seems to have been arising, with the prisoner beginning to be regarded as actually an inferior being, just as in ancient times. The sentiment gradually spread that mere contact with the prisoners was an insult to a free man. It is considered inadmissible for a non-prisoner to eat the same food as a prisoner, to sleep under the same roof, or have any friendly relations with him. Things reached the stage where the head of a camp admonished the man in charge of the disinfestation chamber for allowing a shirt belonging to a free mechanic employed in the power plant to be put in with the prisoner's clothes for delousing. Tilde, as a recent Soviet article puts it, a camp commandant did not regard the prisoners as human. Free citizens in Kolyma sometimes tried to help prisoners they came in contact with. In particular, we are told, doctors, engineers, geologists would try to get their professional colleagues employed according to their capacities. A geologist now described as a hero of the North lost his own life owing to an attempt to defend some of the Kolyma inmates. One of his interventions is described. These people might die. What people? The representative of the camp administration smiled, these are enemies of the 2988 people. As a camp official told a foreign prisoner, we are not trying to bring down the mortality rate. A recent Soviet account tells of a commandant refusing the camp doctor's insistence that convalescents not be sent to work in the forest on 400 grams of bread a day. The commandant answered, I spit on your ethics. And sent out the 246 men convalescing, who were all dead in a week. There are many accounts of camp officials, and even doctors, who came to regard the prisoners as their personal serfs. This selection of slaves was sometimes similar even in detail to the illustrations of books about Negro slavery, as when the chief of a Yurtsevo camp section, Samsonov, honored the medical examination with his presence, and with a smile of satisfaction felt the biceps, shoulders, and backs of the new arrivals. It has been maintained that the Soviet forced labor system might be considered as a stage on the way to a new social stratification which might have involved slavery, that is, in the old-fashioned overt sense, though the trend was changed by later events. A Soviet critic has remarked that the whole system in the camps Ivan Denisovich passed through was calculated to choke and kill without mercy every feeling for justice and legality in man, demonstrating in general and in detail such impunity of despotism that any sort of noble or rebellious impulse was powerless before it. The camp administration did not allow the prisoners to forget for a single moment that they had no rights at all. In the 1940s, a prisoner had to take his cap off at a distance of 5 paces when he saw a warder, and keep it off till he was 2 paces past him. Solzhenitsyn tells of a muddled count, leading to recount after recount, and another time an extra count when a missing prisoner has been found. What's all this about? The chief escort screamed. Do you want to sit on your asses in the snow? That's where PLL put you if you like, and that's where PLL keep you till morning. And he sure would. He wouldn't think twice about it if he wanted. It had happened plenty of times before, and sometimes they had to go down on their knees with the guards pointing their guns at the ready. Reports of physical violence are common. Refusal to work seems to have been punished variously, in the Far Eastern area, by immediate shooting, elsewhere, by stripping the offender and standing him in the snow until he submitted, or by solitary confinement on 200 grams of bread. For a second offense, death was usual. And in camp, not only sabotage but also anti-Soviet propaganda might be treated as a capital crime. Occasional tightening of lax discipline in the camps led to the sudden infliction of penalties on a large scale. Appeals to the regulations were treated as repeated and willful refusal to work. In 1937, 400 prisoners were executed in a batch in Karaganda on such charges. A mutiny is reported in a camp near Kiemerovo near the end of 1938. It was, in fact, a strike against rotten food. 14 of the ringleaders, 12 men and 2 women, were shot in front of all the rest of the prisoners, and then details from each hut helped to dig the graves. Apart from these executions for disciplinary reasons, often announced openly in the camps with the purpose of intimidating the occupants further, there were many killings of a different kind. Orders would come from Moscow for the liquidation of a given number of ex-oppositionists, and the quota would then be fulfilled by a cursory reinterrogation, not on activity in the camps, but on newly discovered circumstances in connection with the original offense, transforming it into a capital crime. For mass operations of this kind, special commissions were on occasion sent down, and given special powers and premises where the doomed men were transferred for investigation and death. For example, one such center was established in an abandoned brick factory in the Vorkuta area, where some 1,300 politicals are reported executed in the winter of 1937. In most of the main camp areas, there seem also to have been established special and highly secret central isolation prisons covering a given group of camps. To one such, in Bamlag, we are told that some 50,000 prisoners were transferred for execution in the 2 years 1937 and 1938. The victims were tied up with wire-like logs, stacked in trucks, driven out to a selected area, and shot. The Hungarian communist writer Lengyel, himself a camp veteran, describes one of these special extermination camps in the Norilsk area, as what is evidently intended as authentic background. In his story The Yellow Poppies, the camp is wound up first by the execution of the remaining prisoners, and then by special NKVD squads who move in and execute all the staff and guards. Owing to the permafrost, it is impossible to bury the bodies, and they are piled into veritable hills and covered with truckloads of earth, the whole matter remaining unknown even in neighboring camps, and even when the campsite itself is later reoccupied as a prison hospital. Prisoners are also reported shot to check epidemics, as in December 1941 at Kashva, where the victims are said to have included the Bulgarian. 102. Communist leader Danko Sapunov. There have also long been unofficial reports of barge loads of prisoners no longer able to work, or otherwise superfluous, being sunk in the Arctic seas. One of the missing groups of Polish officers is believed to have been killed in this way, and we are also told that this is how the poet Narbut perished. The Soviet press has lately confirmed the use of this method of liquidation, reporting, for example, that such was the fate of two leading Ukrainian intellectuals, the writer Rihori Epik and the director Lei Kerbas.Tilda. The routine punishment was the punitive isolators built in each camp, and quite deadly. At Solzhenitsyn's, the fellows from 104 had built the place themselves and they knew how it looked: stone walls, a concrete floor, and no window. There was a stove, but that was only enough to melt the ice off the walls and make puddles on the floor. You slept on bare boards and your teeth chattered all night. You got 6 ounces of bread a day and they only gave you hot gruel every third day. 10 days. If you had 10 days in the cells here and sat them out to the end, it meant you'd be a wreck for the rest of your life. You got TB and you'd never be out of hospitals as long as you lived. And the fellows who did 15 days were dead and buried. Even among those who avoided the cells, all the deficiency diseases were rife. Solzhenitsyn's hero, who had lost teeth from scurvy in the Ust-Izma camp in Pokora at a time when he thought he was on his last legs, was lucky enough to recover. With scurvy, wounds opened and abscesses suppurated. Pellagra was equally common. Pneumonia, usually fatal, was a normal hazard. And the direct effects of undernourishment, swelling of the feet and face, and, in its final and lethal stage, swelling of the abdomen, were constantly to be seen. In the farming camps, epidemics of brucellosis are reported. In the northern camps, gangrene, resulting in amputation, was frequent. Tuberculosis was often the immediate cause of death. After about 2 years, women prisoners tended to develop a continuous hemorrhage of the womb. It later became routine, when a corpse was taken to the morgue, to crack his skull with a big wooden mallet to make sure. Escapes were occasionally made, but very seldom with any success. They were acts of desperation, but, of course, there was enough desperation to produce them. In the Pokora area, the NKVD offered a reward of 11 pounds of wheat to anyone turning in an escaped prisoner. In the early 1930s, escaped prisoners in other regions were sometimes sheltered by the peasantry, but this was very seldom true among the terrorized Kolkhoznikovs of the purge period. There were, nevertheless, rare successes. Gypsies, in particular, sometimes reached encampments of their own race where its solidarity saved them from discovery. And odd individuals, like the Spanish communist general El Campesino, made completely successful escapes. Recaptured prisoners were always brutally manhandled, and almost invariably shot. For any escape on the march to the camps from the railheads, the guards were charged with complicity and sentenced to 2 or 3 years, which they continued to serve as guards but without pay. This made them extremely vigilant. In the camps, too, if anybody got out, it was hell on the guards and they kept on the go without food or sleep. It made him so mad they often didn't bring the fellow back alive. One consequence of this vigilance was continual counting of prisoners. The lieutenant stood still and watched. He'd come outside to double-check the count. That was the routine when they left the camp. The men meant more to a guard than gold. If there was one man missing on the other side of the wire, he'd soon be taking his place. ... They counted you twice on the way out, once with the gates still shut, so they knew if they could open them, and then a second time, when you were going through the gates. And if they thought there was something wrong, they did a recount outside. This is one of several interesting parallels with Dostoevsky's account of forced labor in the 1840s, in The House of the Dead. The prisoners are lined up, counted and called over at dawn, midday and nightfall, and sometimes more often during the day, depending on the suspicions of the guards and their ability to count. The guards often made mistakes, counted wrongly, went away and then came back again. Eventually the wretched guards would succeed in arriving at the right figure and lock up the hut. In a general comparison between this century and the last, we note that in Dostoevsky's time prisoners have considerably more freedom of action inside the camp, and were not under such strict guard outside either, though Dostoevsky mentions that his convicts are serving incomparably the worst of the three types of hard labor. With the exception that in Dostoevsky's camp the main sanction is frightful floggings, which sometimes result in death, rather than the isolators, the life of the convict was on the whole preferable in his descriptions to those of Solzhenitsyn and the others. Each convict has his own box with a lock and key. Prisoners keep domestic animals. They do not work on Sundays or feast days, or even on their own name days. Jews and Muslims have parallel privileges. The food is greatly superior, and prisoners on the sick list go into town to buy tobacco, tea, beef, on Christmas Day, suckling pig, even goose. They even have enough bread to spare for the horse of the water carrier. The convicts in the House of the Dead are all, indeed, really guilty of one or another offense, often murder, like the hero Goryan Chikov, though there are about a dozen political prisoners out of 30. Dostoevsky's type of camp was abolished in the 1850s. He makes the point that he is describing the past, but even non-literary prisoners in Stalin's camps were able to make other comparisons. For example, one prisoner was a Polish communist who had served 2 years in Ronki jail in Poland for political offenses. In the Polish jail, the prisoners had been locked in only at night. By day they were allowed in the garden, they were allowed any books from outside, unlimited correspondence, and weekly. 115. Baths. There were five of them in a large room. The penal empire. In the vast empty spaces in the north and the far east, areas as big as fair-sized countries came under complete NKVD control. There were many camps scattered through the Urals, in the Archangel area, and more especially in and around Karaganda and on the new railway being built from Turkestan to Siberia. But in these, the NKVD administered only comparatively small enclaves. Even in the huge Karlag complex around Karaganda, where there were about 100,000 prisoners, they were in camps scattered over an area the size of France among other settlements, mostly of deported free labor. These so-called free exiles were men and women whose innocence was absolutely clear even to the examining judges. In some areas, they were often little more than vagabonds, sleeping under bridges, begging their bread, and seeking work or even arrest to save themselves from starvation. The two biggest true colonies of the NKVD empire were the great stretch of northwestern Russia beyond Kotlas, comprising roughly what is shown on the map as the Komi Autonomous Soviet Socialist Republic, and the even vaster area of the Far East centered on the gold fields of Kalyma. These regions had, before the NKVD took over, populations of a handful of Russians and a few thousand Arctic tribesmen. A decade later, they held between them something between 1.25 and 2 million prisoners. For these great areas we have accounts from both Soviet and émigré publications. One day in the life of Ivan Denisovich is set in the northeastern camps. General Gorbatov's Years Off My Life covers his experiences in Kalyma. These and other Moscow published works confirmed and complemented the large amount of material long available in the West. The Soviet Arctic is a world of its own. The feeling of having been thrown out from normal life was accentuated by the physical phenomena. In winter, there is the extreme, extravagant cold, the short days in which a swollen, livid sun raises itself for a few hours above the horizon, or, in the Arctic proper, simply lightens the sky somewhat without appearing, the soundlessly flickering ion stream of the aurora borealis. In summer, the long days, the mosquitoes, the slushy swamp of the melted surface, with its alien vegetation, bog cotton and dwarf willow a few inches high, and below it, hard as rock, the permafrost. South of this true tundra is the even wilder forest belt, the taiga, where the great complex of timber camps lay. Most of the northern camps were separated from the country as a whole by vast stretches of empty land, sparsely inhabited by tribal hunters, the Chukchi, Yakut, Nentsi, the last being the Samoyeds, cannibals, from whom Ivan the Terrible had recruited his fiercest guards. Most of these were happy to turn in prisoners for a bounty, having in any case a general hostility to Russians. Kalyma. The largest camp area was that which came under Dolstroy, the Far Eastern Construction Trust. The exact boundaries of Dolstroy's control have never been exactly determined, but it seems to have included all the territory beyond the Lena and north of the Aldan, at least as far east as the Jidin Range, a territory four times the size of France. Its prison population was never as large as the Pokhara regions, being usually around 500,000. But the death rate was so high that more individual prisoners inhabited its camps at one time or another than any other region. Since it was supported by sea, and the number of ships, their capacity, and their average number of trips are known with reasonable accuracy, we can compute a probable minimum of 2 million dead. The main concentration of camps was in the Kalyma gold fields, based on Magadan, with its port of Nagayevo. Gold mining started on a big scale in the early 1930s. In 1935, a series of awards was announced in the gold mining industry, with great publicity to all concerned. Most of those named were mentioned as working at Kalyma, under E.P. Berzin, the director. High among the awards of orders, a different decree was inserted, commuting the sentences and restoring the civil rights of five engineers in the gold industry for their services. Berzin is described as comparatively reasonable about prisoners. Complaints. He, his wife, and his chief assistant, Filipov, who is said to have committed suicide in Magadan prison, were arrested, together with scores of others, in 1937, in Yazhov's purge of the NKVD. There seems to have been some apprehension of resistance, and Berzin was promised awards and promotion, feted by the NKVD delegation, and only arrested on the airfield. He was succeeded by K.A. Pavlov, who, through his deputy, Baranin, launched on a campaign of, even by NKVD standards, maniac terror, torture, and execution, with the shooting in 1938 of an estimated 26,000 men in a special camp, Serpantinka, set up for the purpose. Garanin was soon shot, and his successor, Vishnevetsky, also lasted a very short time, receiving 15 years for a disastrous expedition intended to open up new areas. Pavlov himself was promoted to head Gulag, and was succeeded in Kolyma by Ivan Nikishov, described as icily, mercilessly cruel. He married an NKVD woman, Gritisova, who was put in charge of the women's camp at Magadan. They lived in a comfortable country house 45 miles northwest of Magadan, in their own hunting preserve. The slave route to Kolyma had its own middle passage, the trip to Magadan from Vladivostok by boat, with thousands of prisoners battened down under hatches. The trip took a week or more, and was much feared. An alternative route was tried to Ambarchik on the Arctic Ocean, at the mouth of the Kolyma, a 4,000-mile voyage through difficult seas, taking some 2 months. The first ship sent that way, the Jerma, was caught in the autumn ice, and when arrived in Ambarchik the following year, 1934, none of its 12,000 prisoners remained. This was at a time when the exploring ship Kilyushkin was caught in the ice and sank, and there was worldwide interest in the safety of its crew capped on the ice. American and other offers to try to rescue them by air were refused, and it has been suggested that the reason was that their camp was only a couple of hundred miles from the wintering place of the Jerma, which might have been stumbled upon by foreign flyers. More usually, the shorter passage to Magadan, on the Jerma, the Indigirka, the Dalstroy, and other freighters, was the prisoners' route. The ships, referred to by Andrei Sakharov as death ships of the Okhotsk Sea, were the scene of the worst of the Irkutsk acts. It was on the Jerma that General Gorbatov lost his boots, see here. By 1939, the guards were not entering the prisoners' hold, only waiting outside with raised guns when the prisoners were let out on deck in small groups to go to the latrine. As a result, the Irkutsk had a freer hand than at any other time. There were always numbers of murders and rapes. In 1939, on the Jerma, the criminals managed to break through a wall and get at the provisions, after which they set the storeroom on fire. The fire was held in check, though it was still burning when the Jerma entered port. But there was no attempt to release the prisoners locked in the hold, and a great panic ensued when they realized that if it came to the point, they would be abandoned. A similar tale, perhaps a version of the same event, is told by a Soviet writer. The ship took fire. Male prisoners tried to break out and were battened down in the hold. When they went on rioting, the crew hosed them down to keep them quiet. They then forgot about them. As the fire was still burning, the water boiled and the wretched men died in it. For a long time afterwards the Jerma stank intolerably. Equals. On another occasion, several hundred young girls, sentenced for unauthorized absence from arms factories and so on, were in a compartment of the hold on their own. Again the Irkutsk managed to break through and raped many of them, killing a few male prisoners who tried to protect them. This time, the combination of the rapes, the breakage, and the murders resulted in the arrest of the commander of the ship's guard. On arrival at Nagayevo, first the sick were carried ashore on stretchers and left on the beach in tidy rows. The dead were also neatly stacked so that they could be counted and the number of death certificates would tally. The survivors found themselves in a strange land. The Kolyma Basin alone is almost as big as the Ukraine. It is intensely cold, the temperature may go down to 70 degrees Celsius. Outside work for prisoners was compulsory until it reached 50 degrees Celsius. In spite of this, in 1938, fur was banned in the Dalstroy camps, and only wading permitted, felt shoes were replaced by canvas. The rivers of the region are ice-bound for 8 to 9 months of the year. A camp rhyme ran. Kolyma, wonderful planet, 12 months winter, the rest summer. For about 2 months in winter, there is no sunrise at all. One calmly written account of the Kolyma camps has as a natural chapter heading, sickness, self-mutilation, suicide. Not, of course, that these were limited to Kolyma. But in Kolyma the death rate was particularly high, and the despair rate, too. Gorbatov, a strong man with great willpower who had even resisted interrogation successfully, tells us that he barely survived less than a year in the gold camps. The death rate among the miners is estimated in fact at about 30% per annum, though it varied to some extent with location, type of work, and personality of Commandan. A Kalama prisoner comments that it is rarely possible to live on the camp ration for more than 2 years. By the fourth, at the very latest, the prisoner is incapable of work, and by the fifth year he can no longer be alive. In one of the Kalama penal camps which had started a year with 3,000 inmates, 1,700 were dead by the end, and another 800 in hospital with dysentery. In another, a regular camp, it is estimated that 2,000 out of 10,000 died in a year. Of some 3,000 Poles, over a period of about 15 months, about 60% were counted dead. A Soviet article of 1988 says that of every 100 inmates of Kalama, only 2 or 3 survived. In a camp there described in the Khrushchev period press, inmates did a 12-hour day. The food ration for 100% norm was 800 grams of bread per day. Non-fulfillment of norms, through whatever cause, automatically entailed a reduction of the bread ration to 500 grams. This was just above starvation level. Any further reduction to 300 grams, as a punitive measure, meant certain death. Work at the surface gold sites was performed in accordance with a strict division of labor. Two men had to start a bonfire, and this had to be done without matches, by the ancient method of striking sparks with flints. Another man had to fetch water from the frozen river and melt it. Next, the deeply frozen ground had to be softened, then excavated, and the sand passed through sieves in search of gold. Three youths of about 17 appeared in this camp. They looked younger than their age, perhaps because they were so thin as to be almost emaciated. After the death of the father of one of them, the son had found a collection of Lenin's works, and in the last volume an envelope containing a copy of Lenin's testament. Not keeping it a secret, he and his closest associates were arrested on a charge of terrorism and counter-revolution, and sentenced to 15 years hard labor. So there they all were, three boys and two girls in Kalama and others of the youthful group dispersed in other prison camps. There were several women's camps in the Kalama area. Eugenia Ginsburg, the mother of the writer Aksionov, who became a nurse just in time to save her life, and survive to be rehabilitated, gives an account of the Elgin camp which makes it clear that it was a killer. She describes the impossibility of the tree-felling norm, the trade in sex, the using up of the quota of medical exemptions on the common criminals, and the sole methods of survival, threats, intrigue and graft. Women prisoners who had become illegally pregnant in illicit camp intercourse were among those sent to Elgin. They were allowed to try to feed their babies, but milk hardly came, owing to the rations and work, and after a few weeks usually ceased altogether, whereupon the baby would have to fight for its life on patent foods. As a result, the turnover of mothers was very rapid. Even worse was the women's disciplinary camp at Mylga where they worked in. 139. The Gypsum Quarries. Gorbatov and others note NKVD officers saving old mates in the services or the party by giving them easy jobs. This old boys' network was all very well for those with good connections. A Soviet source gives the other side of the picture. A commandant discovered his former general among the doomed Ohodyagi, goners and gave him a post in the store. A Jew called Dadya Schmaller, who had been a trouble to the authorities through constantly demanding his rights under the regulations, was then in the punitive isolator on 300 grams of bread a day, and unlikely to survive. When he heard of the general being saved, he put in one last formal complaint, about his ration, but merely received a further spell in the isolator. Another disciplinary case is of a team accused of concealing gold which they had dug up. Their quarters were thoroughly searched, but nothing was found. However, in order to teach the men a lesson, the whole team was sentenced to solitary confinement in a punitive section known as Stalin's Villa. Only a few survived. For administration was even harsher than elsewhere, and more capricious too. One prisoner in Kalama finished his sentence at the end of 1937 and was given a paper to sign stating that he had been notified of his liberation. However, he was not given any document to identify him as a free citizen, and could not leave the camp without one. He continued to work as a convict with the ambiguous status of free prisoner. He did not protest, as even so he was doing better than most people, who simply got a fresh sentence. At the end of 1939, he was finally given his certificate of liberation and allowed to choose a place of residence in European Russia apart from his home area. By a circumstance unique in the history of the labor camp zones, Magadan was visited in 1944 by the Vice President of the United States, Henry Wallace. With him, representing the Office of War Information, was Professor Owen Lattimore. They both wrote accounts of what they saw, which differ in various respects from the information we have from ex-prisoners. Wallace found Magadan idyllic. The horrible Nikishov, he noted approvingly, gambled about, enjoying the wonderful air. He noted Gritisova's maternal solicitude, and much admired the needlework which she showed him. The true story of the needlework is that women prisoners capable of producing this were able to sell it for extra rations to the NKVD aristocracy's wives to decorate their apartments. It was normally produced, that is, after a 10 or 12 hour working day in conditions comparable with those adversely commented on by Thomas Hood in The Song of a Shirt. In a similar way, Solzhenitsyn mentions three artists in his camp, who gained certain privileges as a reward for doing pictures free for the higher-ups. Lattimore condemned the hardness of the Tsarist system in Siberia. But this had now, fortunately, passed. The Soviet opening up of the North was Ordini, being controlled by a remarkable concern, the Dalstroy, which can be roughly compared to a combination of the Hudson Bay Company and the TVA. He was equally impressed with Mr. Nikishov and his wife. Mr. Nikishov, the head of Dalstroy, had just been decorated with the Order of Hero of the Soviet Union for his extraordinary achievement. Both he and his wife have a trained and sensitive interest in art and music and a deep sense of civic responsibility. Lattimore approvingly quotes another member of his party on a local ballet troupe which provided high-grade entertainment, which, he adds, just naturally seems to go with gold and so does high-powered executive ability. Lattimore notes, too, that unlike the old gold rushes, with their sin, gin and brawling, Dalstroy concentrated on greenhouses where tomatoes, cucumbers, and even melons were grown to make sure that the hardy miners got enough vitamins. The tomatoes that Lattimore was so lyrical about were indeed grown in the area. A prisoner describes some under the charge of a bullying but efficient woman doctor at a prisoner's hospital in the northern region of Kalyma. Most of the tomatoes went to officials and staff, but at least some reached the patients, which is remarked on as an extraordinary thing. Nikishov had indeed shown some of the executive ability Lattimore attributes to him. For the reception had been very well organized. All prisoners in the area were kept in their huts. Watchtowers were demolished. Various other deceptions were undertaken. For example, Wallace was shown a farm, the best in the area. Fake girl swineherds, who were in fact NKVD office staff, replaced the prisoners for the occasion. All the goods that could be scraped up in the neighborhood were put in the shop windows, and so on. The party was actually taken to a gold mine in the Kalyma Valley. Lattimore prints a photograph of a group of husky men bearing little resemblance to accounts of the prisoners from current Soviet or other sources. It is captioned, "They have to be strong to withstand winter's rigors." The comment is a sound one, but when it came to real prisoners it worked out the other way. Since they were not expected to withstand the winter's rigors, it was unnecessary to keep them strong. Bakora. No other camp area had quite the reputation of Kalyma for isolation, cold, and death. But there were others which ran it close, in particular, the vast prison region at the northeastern corner of European Russia in the basin of the Pechor River. Even its name, though there is no river of Europe outside Russia larger than it, except only the Danube, is practically unknown in the West. Its basin is larger than the British Isles, or the New England, New York, and New Jersey. Here, between Kotlas, the gateway to the area, and the Vorkuta coal mining district, lay the largest single concentration of forced labor in Russia, holding more than 1 million prisoners. In Vorkuta, the temperature is below 0 Celsius for two-thirds of the year, and for more than 100 days the Konovi, or wind of winds, blows across the tundra. The climate killed those from the southern parts of Russia. 150. Very quickly, few would be alive after a year or two. As has been seen, much of our evidence comes from this region. The head of the Pechora camps in 1936 was NKVD Major Moroz, who is variously described as particularly cruel and as sensible enough to give good rations and good conditions in exchange for good work. He himself had briefly been a convict between high NKVD appointments. And he later disappeared. His assistant, Bogarov, a man of the most brutal and ferocious appearance, seems in fact to have been as humane as his post permitted, and to have been behind these improved conditions. Moroz was succeeded by a confirmed sadist, Kushkitin, of whom it was said that the only safety from him lay in his being ignorant of one's existence. After a few months of his rule, there were 2,000 convicts in the isolators of a single camp group, of whom only 76 survived. Kushkitin's brutality availed him no more than Moroz's humanity. He, too, disappeared with all his subordinates at the end of the Azov period. Norilsk, on the Arctic Ocean, was developed as a metallurgical project. A recent article in Izvestia tells us that though there was death on a large scale from unbearable toil, dystrophy, scurvy, and catarrhal diseases, there are about 2 million survivors of the nightmare barracks from the intake of the post-war years still alive today, a striking testimony to the number in the camps. And so it was, on a smaller but still vast scale, throughout the NKVD's realm, from the White Sea to Sakhalin, from the great complexes of Karaganda to the virtually unrecorded death camps of the Tamar and Novaya Zemlya, from, as Solzhenitsyn puts it, the pole of cold at Oymyakoy to the copper mines of Jezkazgan. Slave economics. The millions of slave laborers at the disposal of Gulag played an important economic role, and indeed became accepted as a normal component of the Soviet economy. An ad hoc committee of the United Nations appointed under resolutions by UNESCO and the ILO, and consisting of a prominent Indian lawyer, a former president of the Norwegian Supreme Court, and a former Peruvian minister of foreign affairs, reported in 1953 in a sober document leaving no doubt of the considerable significance of forced labor in the Soviet Union. State-owned slaves were common in the ancient world. For example, the Laurian silver mines were operated by Athens on that basis. The Romans, too, had their servi publici. The head of the Department of War Engineering Armaments, RSFSR, wanting some hundreds of prisoners for urgent work during the war, was told by the NKVD official responsible that there was a shortage. Malenkov and Voznesensky need workers, Voroshilov is calling for road builders. What are we to do? The fact is we haven't yet fulfilled our plans for imprisonment. Demand is greater than supply. We think of the lumber camps as typical. But the best estimate seems to be that, of the comparatively low camp population of early 1941, only about 400,000 were held at lumbering. The other main categories were mining 1 million, agriculture 200,000, hired out to various state enterprises 1 million. Construction and maintenance of camps and manufacture 600,000 of camp necessities. General construction 3,500,000. Even in the great lumbering area of the Northwest, a high proportion of prisoners were building the Kotlas, Vorkuta Railway. Many others were erecting, like Solzhenitsyn's hero, various industrial and mining buildings. It has often been pointed out that slave labor is economically inefficient. Karl Marx had the same view. The lowest possible wage which the slave earns appears to be a constant, independent of his work, in contrast to the free workers. The slave obtains the means necessary to his subsistence in natural form, which is fixed both in kind and in quantity, whereas the remuneration of the free worker is not independent of his own work. Slavery thus owed part of its inefficiency to lack of incentives. The same point is put by the Webbs, in a passage worth quoting at length as representing a certain way of looking at Soviet affairs common in the 1930s. They are criticizing Professor Chernyavin's first-hand account of the camps he served in. It is to be regretted that this testimony, very naturally strongly biased, mixes up personal observation and experience of conditions that are, in all conscience, bad enough, with hearsay gossip unsupported by evidence, and with manifestly exaggerated statistical guesses incapable of verification. The account would have carried greater weight if it had been confined to the very serious conditions of which the author had personal knowledge. His naive belief that this and other penal settlements are now maintained and continuously supplied with thousands of deported manual workers and technicians, deliberately for the purpose of making, out of this forced labor, a net pecuniary profit to add to the state revenue, will be incredible by anyone acquainted with the economic results of the chain gang, or of prison labor, in any country in the world. It is quite true that the mass arrests remain basically a political phenomenon. The slave labor motive can only have been secondary. The engineers and scientists, the doctors and lawyers, were not arrested simply to provide a corps of incompetent lumberjacks. As Weisberg says, after 20 years of endless trouble and enormous expense, the Soviet government finally developed a working body of really capable physicists. And now what's happened? Shuvnikovy, one of the leading low-temperature physicists in the country, is to help dig a canal in the Arctic. So is our first director, Professor Obramov, also a leading Soviet physicist and an expert on crystallography. Can't you imagine what expensive navvies men like Shuvnikov and Obramov are? But once people were arrested, the extraction of their physical labor ensured at least some contribution to the economy, and, granted the initial irrationality of the whole purge, there is nothing contrary to reason and common sense in Stalin's typical decision to integrate them into his economic machine. To this extent, the Webbs are simply wrong as to Stalin's motives. Moreover, Stalin was well aware of Marx's economic objection to slavery. And with his usual refusal to accept precedent, he sought to overcome it by the simple but untried method of not giving the slave a flat subsistence, but linking his rations to his output. In this way, it was thought, the lack of incentive Marx had pointed to was overcome. It is quite true that the forced labor projects were, anyhow, like much else in Stalin's economy, often totally misconceived even on their own terms. During the great wave of arrests in 1947, a Soviet account tells us, Stalin remarked at a meeting of the Council of Ministers that the Russian people had long dreamed of having a safe outlet to the Arctic Ocean from the Obi River. Simply on the basis of this remark, decisions were taken to build a railway to Igarka. For more than 4 years, amid feet of snow, in temperatures down to minus 55 degrees Celsius in winter, and with swamps and mosquitoes in the summer, forced laborers toiled at this vest project, at more than 80 campsites at intervals of 15 kilometers along the 1,300-kilometer stretch. The estimated cost, if it had ever been completed, was from 4 to 6 million rubles per kilometer. In the end, 850 kilometers of rail, and 450 of telegraph poles only, had been completed. After Stalin's death, the line, the signals, the railway stations, the locomotives, and all that had been erected were 157. Abandoned to rust in the snow. But this was an irrationality of the Soviet political and planning system itself. When it came to an ordinary operation, such as logging, it might seem that a method of providing very cheap labor had indeed been found. Some prisoners made efforts on the spot to estimate the economic value of the camps. A friend of mine who was in a logging camp in the Vorkuta area worked for a time on the administrative side there, from 1950 to 1952, and says that the results were to a large degree faked or inflated, as in ordinary Soviet factories at that time. A great deal of the work which counted against norms was of a valueless nature, and although the prisoners themselves received the barest minimum of all necessities, the total cost of the camp, with guards, administration, and so forth, was much in excess of the value of its output. Antony Eckhart reports much the same of the Vorkuta. 158. Mines which, however, would probably have been uneconomic even if run by free labor because of the distances involved in the total production. 159. Effected. And a careful study makes the supposed savings due to forced labor over the whole economy at best marginal. A Soviet account reinforces this view. The writer recalls a conversation in which one of the technicians on the job, himself a former prisoner, commented on the suggestion that the use of convict labor for construction projects was relatively cheap. It merely seems so. After all, the prisoners have somehow to be fed, shod, clothed, and guarded, special areas have to be constructed, provided with watchtowers for the guards, yes, and for that matter the maintenance of the guards is a costly matter. Then also there is the physical training section and all the other sections which in fact only exist on paper, in fact a sizable establishment. Then there are those again who have to fetch the water for them, heat the baths and wash the floors. After all, there are a lot of things that human beings need. There are also many duty officers and personnel, the hewers of wood and drawers of water, the countless carpenters, clerks and other scabs as they are called in the camp. So that if one averages it out, you must reckon 1.5 ancillary persons for every one who actually works. The other main thing is that the guards cannot deploy the labor force as it ought to be, either one is not allowed to use the proper machinery, or else the foreman, not to mention the convicts themselves, simply have no time to stop and think about how to organize the labor force because of the consequent parades, inspections, and the rest of the to-ing and fro-ing. The maintenance of the guards, it may be remarked, was also a military debit. Throughout the war period, the camps continued to be guarded by picked NKVD soldiers, in a proportion of about one guard to 20 inmates. The Soviet government thus forfeited the use of certainly no fewer than 250,000 trained and healthy troops. Even so, in certain circumstances, forced labor does seem to have paid. Coal from Karaganda was sometimes noticeably cheaper than that from the Donetsk Basin. Moreover, there are certain fields where free labor would be inordinately expensive, and where slave labor is probably economically preferable, for instance, in the mines and strategic roads of northeastern Siberia. In 1951, in the United States Congress, the immense labor cost of setting up an American air base in Greenland was disclosed. We can be sure that the equivalents in northern Siberia were completed far more cheaply with slave labor than they could have been with even Soviet free labor. That is to say, while it is true that the forced labor system was not limitlessly expandable, it may have paid in certain fields. In any case, to start examining the economics of the operation in an abstract way is clearly a mistake. A man killed by squeezing a year or two's effort out of him is of more use than a man kept in prison. The camps were politically efficient. They effectively isolated masses of potential troublemakers, and were a great disincentive to any sort of anti-Stalinist activity, or even talk. Assuming that the political purging was necessary, the camps were a useful end product. Like everything else in Stalin's epoch, the system operated by pressure from the top down. Every camp had its plan, and every camp chief worked under a system of penalties and rewards. There were some odd results. Camp chiefs are reported as having kept recaptured prisoners whom they should have returned to their original camps. Again, in the prison at Kotlas, there was a group of prisoners consisting entirely of invalids and old people, whom none of the camps would accept, for obvious economic reasons. They remained there for over a year as the problem solved itself by their dying, food and death. In the camps, the commandants operated the norm system vis-à-vis the prisoners. As a general principle, there were various cauldrons, or food allotments. The principle is simple enough. Precise figures varied considerably, but the following shows a typical proportion. In the Kalama camps, for men doing 12 to 16 hours heavy physical labor a day, 8 months of it in very low temperatures, the daily ration, of very poor bread, is given as follows by a former prisoner writing in the West. For more than 100% of the norm up to 930 grams, 32 ounces, for 100% 815 grams, 28% oz, for 70 to 99% 715 grams, 25 ounces, for 50 to 69% 500 grams, 17% oz, disciplinary ration 300 grams, 10% oz, 163. Plus soup, 3% oz, of salt fish, and just over 2 ounces of groats, a Soviet account of the same area gives. For 100% fulfillment 800 grams, non-fulfillment for whatever reason 500 grams. Punitive 300 grams equals. The first is given in ounces in the original, so the slight discrepancy has no significance. What seems to be the abolition of the intermediate stage may be due to the fact that the Russian was serving there later, from 1942 until at least 1950, as against the others circa 1938 to 1946. A Polish account, of 1940 to 1941, gives 500 grams for 50% norm and 300 for 165. Less. Another reported ration scheme, in one of the northern camps in the winter of 1941-1942. For the full norm 700 grams of bread, plus soup and buckwheat. For those not attaining the 400 grams of bread, plus soup norm. Most Arctic arrangements were probably close to these two. The ration outside the Arctic proper was rather lower, typically. Over 100% 750, 1000 grams 100% 600 to 650 grams 50, 100% 400 to 475 grams penal, under 50%, 300, 400 grams. These rations may be compared with those of a camp system more familiar to Western readers, that of one of the Japanese POW camps on the River Kwai, the Mekong. There, prisoners got a daily ration norm of 700 grams of rice, 600 of vegetables, 100 of meat, 20 of sugar, 20 of salt, and 5 of oil, for a total of 3,400 calories, but, as in Russia, very deficient in vitamins. Even in the 1980s in the USSR, the camp norm was of 2,400 calories only, mainly based on 700 grams of black bread. We can make certain other comparisons. In the Ukrainian cities in the famine period of the 1930s, the bread ration was 800 grams for industrial workers, 600 for manual workers, 400 for office employees. In the siege of Leningrad, in 1941 to 1942, about one-third to one-half of the population remaining in the city died of hunger, mostly during the first winter. The rations in the worst period were: October 1941, the basic ration was down to 400 grams of bread a day for workers and 200 grams for dependents. Late November, 250 grams for workers and 125 for dependents 1941. Late December, up to 350 grams for workers and 200 for dependents 1941. At Leningrad, there were small additional rations of meat and sugar. Lumber workers got a supplementary ration above the norm, and a truly major difference is that in camps the prisoners never got their full ration. And if there was a bad or inedible portion of the original bulk ration, that was the part that went to them. Solzhenitsyn describes what happens to the groat issue. Shukov had had thousands of these rations in prisons and camps, and though he'd never had a chance to weigh a single one of them on a scale, he and every other prisoner had known a long time that the people who cut up and issued your bread wouldn't last long if they gave you honest rations. Every ration was short. The only question was, by how much? The reason was obvious. When they left in the morning, the cook got an issue of groats from the big kitchen in the camp. It worked out to about 2 ounces a head, about 2 pounds for each gang. That is, a little over 20 pounds for everybody working on the site. The cook didn't carry that stuff himself on the 2-mile march from the camp. He had a trustee who carried it for him. He thought it was better to slip an extra portion of the stuff to a trustee at the expense of the prisoners' bellies rather than to break his own back. Then there was water and firewood to carry in the stove to light. The cook didn't do that either. He had other prisoners and goners to do it. And they got their cut too. It's easy to give away things that don't belong to you. All the cook did was put groats and salt in the cauldron, and if there was any fat he split it between the cauldron and himself. The good fat never got as far as the prisoners. Only the bad stuff went in the cauldron, then his only job was to stir the mush when it was nearly ready. The sanitary inspector didn't even do that much. He just sat and watched. When the mush was ready, the cook gave him some right away and he could eat all he wanted. And so could the cook. Then one of the gang bosses, they took turns, a different one every day, came to taste it and see if it was good enough for the men to eat. He got a double portion too. After this, the whistle went off. Now the other gang bosses came and the cook handed them their bowls through a kind of hatch in the wall. The bowls had this watery mush in them. And you didn't ask how much of the ration they'd really put in it. You'd get hell if you opened your mouth. And so it was with everything, they stole all the way down the line. Out here on the site, in the camp, and in the stores too. The system was made more effective yet, in the lumber camps in particular, by turning it into a brigade, a gang, matter, with collective responsibility for inadequate work. You might ask why a prisoner worked so hard for 10 years in a camp. Why didn't they say to hell with it and drag their feet all day long till the night, which was theirs? But it wasn't so simple. It was like this, either you all got something extra or you all starved. You're not pulling your weight, you swine, and I've got to go hungry because of you. So work, you bastard. So when a really tough job came along, like now, you couldn't sit on your hands. Like it or not, you had to get a move on. Either they made the place warm within 2 hours or they'd all be fucking well dead. The brigade leader, himself a prisoner, worked out with a foreman, the team surveyor, the amount of work done by his brigade. Other camp officials then estimated the production compared with the daily norm. Their decisions were then sent to the food department for rationing according to the output. More depended on the work rates than the work itself. A clever boss who knows his business really sweats over these work rates. That's where the ration comes from. If a job hasn't been done, make it look like it had. If the rates were low on a job, try to hike them up. You had to have brains for this and a lot of pull with the fellows who kept the worksheets. And they didn't do it for nothing. But come to think of it, who were these rates for? For the people who ran the camps. They made thousands on the deal and got bonuses on top for the officers. Like old Vokovoy, with that whip of his. And all you got out of it was 6 ounces of bread in the evening. Your life depended on them. On one occasion, the gang boss gets better rates. This means that they'd have good bread rations for 5 days. Well, maybe 4. The higher-ups always cheat on 1 day out of 5. As to the quality of the food, the convicts in Solzhenitsyn's book discuss the film Battleship Potemkin. The maggots on the meat which cause the mutiny are thought to be unrealistically large, and this is explained as necessary from the film point of view. Then comes the comment, if they brought that kind of meat to the camp, I can tell you, and put it in the cauldron instead of the rotten fish we get, I bet we'd. 7. He describes a meal. The gruel didn't change from one day to the next. It depended on what vegetables they'd stored for the winter. The year before they'd only stocked up with salted carrots, so there was nothing but carrots in the gruel from September to June. And now it was cabbage. The camp was best fed in June, when they ran out of vegetables and started using groats instead. The worst time was July, when they put shredded nettles in the cauldron. The fish was mostly bones. The flesh was boiled off except for bits on the tails and the heads. Not leaving a single scale or speck of flesh on the skeleton, Shukov crunched and sucked the bones and spat them out on the table. He didn't leave anything, not even the gills or tail. He ate the eyes too when they were still in place, but when they'd come off and were floating around in the bowl on their own he didn't eat them. The others laughed at him for this. The second course was a mush made from Megara. It was one solid lump, and Shukov broke it off in pieces. When it was hot, never mind when it was cold, it had no taste and didn't fill you. It was nothing but grass that looked like millet. They'd gotten the bright idea of serving it instead of groats. It came from the Chinese, they said. They got 10 ounces of it and that was that. It wasn't the real thing, but it passed for mush. The ration, and the whole estimate of norms, depended on all sorts of factors. First, the ideas of the officials in determining the piecework. 4. Some types of work, it was on occasion set far above the possible, for example, in building the Kotlas, Vorkuta Railway. It was impossible to do more than about 30% of the quota, so the ration, for this extremely hard work, was down to 400 grams, on the extension down to Comer. 180. U, average expectation of life was about 3 months. Again, the goodness or badness of the year's harvest immediately affected rations. The bad harvest of 1936 produced an appalling level of mortality from starvation in the camps in 1937. Trouble was caused by the desire to eat anything at all. Rubbish boxes from the kitchens might be attacked by gangs. When these, in one camp, were thrown into the cesspool by the latrines, even there the gangs waited after them. When grass came up, every blade might be put in a tin and boiled and eaten. Grass eating was most common among intellectuals. Its long-term effects were deadly. Others tried to satisfy their appetites with. 182. Boiling salt water, also ineffective. Even in Solzhenitsyn's penal camp, there are convicts who have served in worse places, a lumber camp where work went on until midnight if necessary to fill the quotas, and the basic ration was 6 ounces less. In the area of the far north, to the east of the Urals, there seem to have been a number of camps of particularly rigorous regime, which are described as of complete isolation. Only a few rumors about them have emerged, as no one seems in any circumstances to have been released. The death rate is said to have been very high. Novaya Zemlya had an extremely bad reputation, with few, if any, returning. Special punitive camps are often reported. After the introduction of a new and harsher regime of Katorga in the early 1940s, those so sentenced were deprived of blankets and mattresses for the first 3 years and otherwise. 184. Subjected to harder labor, longer hours, and worse conditions. Sometimes, as in the Jido camp, offending prisoners were put in chains for the remainder of their sentences. For women, the Stalinogorsk camp was particularly severe. Inmates worked in iron and coal mines. The second Alexeyevka camp, in the Kargopol group, a particularly bad one listed as a disciplinary camp but in fact full of foreign prisoners who had had no time to commit offenses in other camps, had a large number of Polish Jews who had escaped from the Nazi persecution and died like flies. They hated the 186 Soviet regime more bitterly and passionately than anyone in the camps. In one respect, Solzhenitsyn was lucky. He was not in a lumber camp. Here rations were notoriously low, and work was extremely hard. Professor Swyanuix, who was himself in a lumber camp at one time, says that the former inmates are inclined to overestimate the proportion of prisoners sent to such work, probably because they were under the constant fear of being sent to the forest. It was the equivalent of a death sentence for a person not accustomed to heavy physical work to be assigned for a long period to a felling brigade. One former assistant to a doctor in a northern camp says that in two successive winters about 50% of the workers in some forestry brigades died. Overall, about 30% of the labor force was lost. 188. By death or total exhaustion per annum. A Pole who was briefly in Alexeyevka describes the visible death as extraordinary. He saw two drop dead as they left the gates with other brigades. In his own brigade, three died at the work site on the first day. Trademark: a very active man would sometimes remain healthy by producing 120 or 150% of his quota for a year or 18 months, and then one night would be found dead of heart failure in his bunk. Even comparatively mild lumber camps were great killers. Finnish prisoners who were experts in the matter held that the norms prevailing were impossible even for the best fed workers. They could only be brought down even to the barely tolerable level by various forms of cheating, tufta, and bribery, using the same logs over again by sawing off the stamped end, and so forth. Herling never came across a prisoner who had worked in the forest for more than 2 years. After a year, prisoners were usually incurable and, following transfer as gunners to lighter work, retired to the mortuary. This was the last stage in the camps. When worn down, debilitated to the degree that no serious work could any longer be got out of them, prisoners were put on sub-starvation rations and allowed to hang around the camp doing odd jobs until they died. This category is recognized in Soviet as well as foreign books. Gorbatov, who describes the usual symptoms, confirms that to go sick was ordinarily fatal. For if you did, you had your ration cut and from that point there was no way out. This corps commander was at one time able to sweep the camp office floors, and there found an occasional crust to keep him going. He was himself saved from death by a friendly doctor who got him transferred to an easier post. In general, throughout the period, all our sources emphasize that survival for any length of time was rare in most camps except among those qualifying for functions, office jobs or other work enabling them to escape the main labor of the camp in question. During bad periods, the camps of the disabled and unfit became the most populous, and the largest labor brigades were those of the woodcutters. and the gravediggers. Equals the dead were buried in pits, with small wooden tags attached with string to their legs. One estimate is that a batch of prisoners in the camps would, on the average, lose